I'm absolutely thrilled to revisit CEO Schneider Electric, Annette Clayton's remarkable journey. Annette has recently earned a prestigious place on Time Magazine's inaugural Time 100 Climate List as one of the 100 most influential leaders propelling businesses towards genuine climate action. Annette's insights and leadership lessons are timeless, and I'm really eager to delve into them with you. Many congratulations, Annette, and here goes her incredible journey. A very warm welcome to the show, Annette, and thank you for taking out time. I really value your perspectives.
Thank you, Emma.
Awesome. I'm going to start with sharing a fun fact with you because your journey resonated from that perspective a lot with mine. My dad actually was an entrepreneur and retired only when he turned 84 years back and started his journey as a poultry farmer. And some of my fondest childhood memories are actually from the farm. So I was wondering, it'd be lovely if you can share with us, how did growing up on a farm influence your career?
Well, Emma, it's nice to meet another farm girl. And you're right. I used to call our farm the Noah's Ark farm. We had, you know, two of everything. It wasn't a very big farm, but it definitely taught us the value of hard work, anywhere from, you know, tending the garden to tending the livestock. The other thing that we did is, you know, I come from a working class family and we were always looking for ways to not only pay the bills, but to support me and my endeavors to go to college. So one of the things that my dad and I would do together is in the barn, we would take apart and fix old pickup trucks for other farmers. And, you know, we'd buy old broken down trucks, fix them and resell them. And so I learned at an early age just the confidence of being able to do all these things. Even unfortunately, when I was a young teenager, our house caught fire and we rebuilt it as a family. My brother's 5 years younger than me, and I've seen, you know, subsequent photos of him, you know, carrying a single brick at a time, you know, while my dad rebricked the house and I mixed mortar. And so we just learned how to do everything. And I really feel that this gave me the confidence to enter into the engineering field as I started my college journey.
Thank you for sharing that. So how do you think these early years then contributed to the success in leadership you've seen now?
I think when you grow up, you know, doing things for yourself in more of a, we can do anything that we put our minds to, it builds a lot of confidence. And, you know, not everything was a success. You know, we had failure. So I think it also builds resilience. And as I reflect on those early years, my parents, they really instilled in me independence and they gave me the confidence that you can do things. And I remember painting the barn. My dad was going to hire somebody to paint the barn. And he said, I could hire someone or you could do it. And I thought, it's a big barn. I'm one person. It's a single ladder. Can I really do this? And sure enough, that summer, I painted the entire barn. So I think it's confidence building. It's resilience. It's just the wherewithal to believe you can do things that you don't know how to do today. You can figure it out.
Yeah, very hands-on way of looking at things. I love that. And then shifting gears a little bit, you know, you mentioned in a lot of your interviews, learning is one of your key goals personally and for Schneider. So, you know, love to understand what was the thought process behind prioritizing learning and development as a goal.
Well, I'm a strong believer in lifelong learning, and I think it's really important. And I'm sure that your listeners can probably name the people in their lives or in their professional careers that have continued to learn and those that have just stopped. And I think it's one of the things we face, especially as we get older, especially as we have, you know, teams reinforcing our intelligence that maybe we've learned all we really need to learn. And I think that's absolutely not true. And we know that people that have really strong learning agility, you know, they ramp in roles faster. They are able to develop their strategies faster. Their learning agility comes through in the way they perform their roles. And when I talk about learning agility, I'm really talking about a few things. One is the competencies that you have. The competencies are things that you've developed maybe through university or through learning or through educational kind of courses or sometimes through experience. know-how are the tools that you put in your toolbox. Maybe you're a lean expert. Maybe you're a sustainability expert. These are the know-hows that you've accumulated. And then experiences are those life's experiences. You know, you've lived internationally. You've taken care of an elderly relative. You've been married or divorced or had children. These are life's experiences. And learning agility is about that virtuous cycle of competency, know-how, and experiences. And so it's a very important aspect for me of who I am.
How do you then transfer this to your team down the line?
I definitely encourage them to, one, have the courage to do things that they don't know how to do today. And learning is a big part of that. Learning from others, learning from the market, learning from customers. And so I really do encourage the team to be lifelong learners.
You know, this takes me to something which I believe is a reality, but not everyone talks about. What's your view on imposter syndrome and how do you relate with it?
I think imposter syndrome is something that I've experienced a lot in my career. And I don't have any shame in admitting that every new role that I've taken, you know, throughout my time, there were aspects of it that I did not know how to do. And so in some ways, you do feel like an imposter. People ask you questions you don't understand. People use terminology that seems foreign. And, you know, I think it's a natural part of taking on new responsibilities and new roles, yet we name it the imposter syndrome. And there is this sense of fake it till you make it. But that earlier point that we talked about around confidence and resilience and building that, it gives you the confidence to know that I may not know what to do today, but I trust myself to be able to figure it out. So yes, I've had lots of imposter syndrome and sometimes worse than others. It depends, you know, how far away was the next assignment from the previous assignment and did I have the experience for it? And even at this point in my career, and, you know, I've worked over 20 years in automotive, I've worked, you know, half a dozen years in technology, and now in this energy field, even today, I wonder, am I fully equipped for everything that I'm facing? But yet, it's hard to imagine someone with more perfect experience for this time of, you know, the new energy transition than I am. So I know I'm equipped. So I just have to trust myself that I'll find the right path. So for me, the way I've gotten over imposter syndrome is trusting my instincts.
Thank you for sharing that so candidly. So who were your go-to people in this journey of 20 years? Like, you know, did you have any role models? Did you have any mentors, you know, formal or informal? Love to understand a little bit about how did you sort of give yourself that support?
I did have role models and I had also mentors. And it might surprise you that some of my most valuable mentoring experiences were actually where I was mentoring and I was being mentored at the same time. And I think that's one of the gifts that I realized probably later in my career. But, you know, when you mentor young people, they have a different perspective on the company, on the values, on the organization. And this really helped me frame not only my language to be, you know, more relevant to the generation that we now have in the workplace, millennials, Gen Zs, Gen Xs, but it really allowed me to think about what I was doing as a leader, and it is relevant to a changing organization. And so these mentee relationships with young people have been really important. I've also had a number of peer mentor relationships, and I think they have had a lot of value in helping me understand how I'm perceived and how much influence and impact I'm having amongst my peer group and how I can adapt and adjust. And then there's, of course, the more traditional mentoring relationship. And I've had really only one female mentor in my career. It was really, really early on. And she gave me, I think, one of the better pieces of advice that I've received. She was a Black female working in a primarily male industry. And the piece of feedback that she gave me was, when you are getting a piece of feedback as you're developing professionally, you need to assume it's because you need it. And I know that sounds pretty simple, but it would be easy to assume it's because you're female or because you're a minority. But if you start from the position of I'm getting this feedback because I need it, then you never lose the opportunity to onboard it. And I think there was a lot of feedback in my career that I really needed. Some of it was probably biased, but most of it was not. And I think that that was really good advice that I got from a mentor early on.
You know, when you were sharing this really powerful nugget, I was reflecting on so many conversations I have with my clients. And I think the biggest challenge they face is that they're not able to remove themselves from the situation, take the feedback, you know, personally. And then all those saboteurs hijack you, you know, you feel like a victim, you feel like a judge, you know, you feel judge yourself. So I think that's a great piece of advice. And of course, reverse mentoring is something which I absolutely swear by myself. You know, I call my two sons and their friends my mentors. I love their conversations and love to understand their perspectives. Any anecdotes or stories come to your mind?
Well, I can remember I was dealing with a particularly difficult peer.
Mm-hmm.
And this peer was, you know, very strong in the company, very dogmatic, and we didn't have the best first start. And so I decided that I would take this person's chief financial officer as a mentee. And actually, I lobbied to get this particular individual as my mentee. And honestly, I think I gained as much from the relationship as she did because I wanted to understand how to work better with her boss. I learned a lot about not only the market, maybe the way this particular individual was looking at, you know, the segments and how to grow the business. And I learned a lot that really helped me have a better relationship with this individual. And in this situation, you know, I was quite purposeful about it.
Yeah, and very strategic too. I love that. So, Annette, as a first woman ever on the executive committee to ensure a female representation of 44%, how did you make this possible? I know it's a cool word, but what's been your approach on DEI for Schneider after that?
Well, actually, you know, I didn't make it possible to be the first woman on the Schneider Electric Executive Committee. I mean, that was really the former CEO and now chairman, Jean-Pascal Tricoire. And he had definitely a vision of what he wanted to have in the executive committee. And while I was the first, you know, for probably, you know, maybe a year, 18 months, there were others that followed me. And with each woman that joined the executive committee, it got a little bit easier in the fact that, you know, you weren't the proxy for all women's issues. You know, there were others, you know, you could actually talk about issues that impact business, because as we know, companies that are more diverse actually perform better in the market. I think Catalyst has done a number of studies that demonstrate this. So I was simply the first, and it was, you know, look, there were moments that were tense, but never did I believe they were because I was a woman. I think they were because I was new to the industry and pushing really hard. Now there's, as you said, quite a bit of representation in the company. And I think at one point, all of the operations were being run by women. And so I think Jean-Pascal certainly has been a visionary and quite inclusive with a real mission of what he wanted to do in the company.
Very interesting. So having said that, Annette, what kind of challenges did you face given that you're part of a male-dominated industry? Then how did you navigate them?
I think it's changed, Emma, from, you know, where I started my career to today. You know, and I think we use the word assimilation a lot. I think in my generation of, you know, being maybe the only woman in the room, there was a real probably process of assimilating from everywhere from, you know, what you were wearing to how you were leading. I think we assimilated into this male environment. I don't think that's the case today. And actually, I think that women can bring their genuine self to work today. I know even I have adjusted in that regard. Of course, I faced challenges. There were times when I just simply knew I would need to outwork, outperform, you know, demonstrate that I was a real problem solver. And frankly, one of the ways I was able to do that was to ask for the hardest problems of the company and to get, you know, a reputation of really a problem solver, a change agent. And, you know, I think that helped me a lot. But I'm going to just admit that really I assimilated, especially early in my career. And I don't think that's the right approach today. And I think women in the workforce today can bring, you know, more of their authentic self while still realizing the context that they're, you know, that they're operating in.
Wow. You're one of the first speakers who shared that. I'd love to actually double click on this if it's okay. Can you share instances or how did you assimilate?
Well, if I rewind really early in my career, when you're, you know, working on a factory floor in, you know, an automotive company, you're getting feedback of, you know, well, you're being too emotional or you need to go to this after work thing so that you can be, you know, seen as one of the guys. You assimilate to that kind of feedback. And I think sometimes, especially there's some biases that sometimes emotions are called out when indeed it's just passion. It's passion about what it is that you're doing. It's intensity. It's not necessarily emotion. So I think I had some of those examples, but I can tell you mostly teams of people, when they see you have the best interest of the company, when you have the best interest of them, when you're willing to outwork and be completely dedicated, I mean, most situations you get recognized for that regardless of who you are. And I think for me, that's what I saw. And I know that I had some examples of probably some discrimination, but mostly I would ignore them and I would keep going, or I would assume they weren't that discrimination and I would power through. I think we see, you know, less of that overt activity today, but, you know, I've been in the workforce a long time, so I've seen it really progress and I'm frankly happy about that.
Yeah. So with the wisdom of hindsight, would you do it any differently?
I think there's a couple things that I would have done differently. There were a number of international assignments I could have taken earlier. I think I just didn't have the courage to, you know, it's back to the imposter syndrome, right? I don't know that I had the courage early in my career to go do things I didn't know in cultures I didn't know. And the combination of those two, I found pretty frightening. You know, later in my career, in my 30s, I took multiple back-to-back international assignments. You know, at one point, I spent much more time probably outside the United States than inside. So I think I would have taken those opportunities sooner. I think they're accelerators. And if you can do it, it's great. But the thing I don't regret is when opportunity knocked, I mostly answered the door. Like I said, on international assignments, there were a couple I didn't, but when typically when somebody called and said, hey, we have this special assignment or we have this really hard thing we'd like you to do, I mostly said yes. Yes, thank you. I'd love to go after that. I'd love to try. And, you know, in most cases, I had no idea how to start, let alone how to do it, but you have to trust that you can figure it out. And yeah, I did.
And it, you're talking about a very busy schedule and I want to shift gears a little bit. And I'm wondering, how do you balance your personal life and your professional life?
Well, you know, this is a very, very personal thing. And I, not only for me, but for everyone. And, you know, I won't say that I have the best balance. I don't have children. I have the latitude of being able to do probably things that women with children cannot. But what I have done is I've established my boundaries, you know, what I'm willing to do, what I'm not willing to do. And I've communicated them and then I've forgiven myself for it. And so I often get the question, especially from working moms, how do I do this? And I think, you know, things change over your life, whether you're, you know, you have complete freedom to children you have to help get through testing or children you have to help make their next steps or elder care. And unfortunately, in society today, these things still fall primarily on women, not solely, but probably more than their share. And I think throughout your career, you have to just declare where you are, where your boundaries are to yourself. And then establish that with your boss. But then here's the really important thing. Forgive yourself for it. Because what I see is women that carry guilt, and it's pretty overwhelming about needing to do more here, needing to do more there. And, you know, life is about phases and change, and these things change. So, you know, be flexible, evolve with it, and declare it, but then mostly forgive yourself for wherever you are. Don't keep putting the pressure on yourself to be, you know, superhuman.
Yeah.
If you decide, look, I need to pick the kids up from school at 3 o'clock. It's important I be there. It's important for them to see me. And it's important for me to spend from 3 to 4 every day with them, drive them home, you know, get them their snacks, start them on their homework. But I'm happy to get back online after dinner and work until midnight. That is the boundary that you've created. Mm. You have to create that boundary. You have to communicate that boundary. I'm not taking meetings between 3 and 4. And you have to forgive yourself for that boundary. And what I see is women carrying the guilt of creating the boundary to begin with. So set your priorities and then be good with them.
Yeah, that's a very helpful perspective. Yeah. Given that you're managing a huge team of, I think, 30,000 people. So what is your approach to dealing with millennials versus Gen Z and Gen X in the workplace? You know, you also spoke about navigating culture. So how did you adapt and engage with these different generations?
I think it is important to know that millennials and Gen Z and Gen X's have been an evolution in the workplace. And actually, you know, one of the companies I work with, we named it Alpha Structure. And we named it Alpha because it was the generation of people who are actually being born as this company is starting. And we saw ourselves as serving that generation. I have had to adapt here. I grew up in a very competitive household. I mean, we raced to the barn. We raced to the end of the driveway. Everything was a competition, right? Who could do it bigger, faster, you know, eating ice cream. It didn't matter what it was. And so I'm a very, very competitive person. And, you know, a lot of what motivates me is winning. And a lot of my language can tend to be around competition and winning. And look, that's not necessarily the motivating factor for every person. And it was actually my communications lead at the time, Venancio Figueroa, and he advised me. He said, look, you know, there's a generation out there that really wants to hear about the purpose-driven company that Schneider Electric is. And they like to win, but they're not motivated by winning. And so I really onboarded his advice. I really onboarded his thinking, and I really did begin to change my language. It wasn't insincere at all on my part because, you know, one of the reasons I work for Schneider is because it is such a purpose-driven company, really digital, driving electrification, that being really the formula for sustainability. And this is the core of the company. And so I needed to balance that winning spirit with the purpose-driven company. And I felt that that was one of the things that helped me engage with the generation that's entering the workforce now, where not only what they're doing, but who they're doing it for and what it means in the world is very important to them. They watch their parents work a lot, maybe even, you know, do well, make a lot of money. But what they really want to do is they want to change the world and they want to stop things like climate change. They want to be more sustainable. They want to decarbonize their lives. And these are all core things that Schneider does. I just wasn't leveraging them enough in speaking to those generations.
And does this have anything to do with feedback which you got earlier from your mentor about taking feedback and making that huge change in your narrative, if I may say so?
Well, it is, but I think more importantly, and as you get more senior in an organization, one of the things you really have to do is create the psychological safety for your teams so that they feel they can give you honest feedback. And clearly, you know, Venancio felt he could give me that feedback and then I would onboard it. But you have to create the psychological safety in your team so that they can communicate to you, you know, what's going well and what's not going well. That's part of building, you know, a high performing team. And I have really strong feelings about how to build a high performing team. I mean, you have to have the obvious things, right? Common goals, common visions, collective accountability. You have to feel that you would run to help the other person, you know, solve a problem. You have to spend time together, for sure. But maybe one of the things that high-performing teams don't do often is create that feedback loop of what's going well, what are we doing well as a team, what are you doing well as a leader, and what's not going well. And I think by creating that psychological safety, you continue to evolve and adapt as a leader. And look, you don't listen to maybe everything, but you never lose the opportunity to get the piece of advice.
Yeah, and see, at least maybe there's a 10% value in that entire piece of advice. And then, you know, how do you approach hiring in your team? You've helped build the talent factory. So what's your hiring strategy? What do you look for in talent? And let's face it, not everybody is going to be a high performer. So how do you get your team to deal with those kind of practical challenges? I know I've asked you a lot of questions in one question.
Yeah, maybe we could talk a little bit about hiring. So if you think a second about hiring, I mean, hiring wants to look like what you want the organization to look like in the future.
Right.
So, you know, if you want more diversity and inclusion in the future, then you have to hire that today because you have fallout along the way. And, you know, one of the things we've been able to do is increase our percentage of gender and diverse hires over time. And, you know, I'm quite proud of the organization for doing that. And you start to see it in leadership. You start to see it in our commercial sales teams. So you're hiring for your future. And I guess it's very obvious, but, you know, if you're going to continue to hire 15% women, you're never going to have 30 or 40% of your workforce as diverse, you know, in gender. And so a lot of times you start with looking at your hiring practices. And so I think you're right to start the question there. And then we're looking for people that are aligned with our mission. Mm-hmm. You know, if you don't want to work on sustainability or you don't think it's important to the future of the world and to future generations, you probably shouldn't come to Snyder. And so I think you look for some alignment and purpose, especially today, because that is what keeps, you know, a lot of retention. It's competitive pay and benefits and all of those things, but those are kind of the table stakes. Do people really want to work on the mission? And then it's back to what skills are they bringing, what competencies, what know-how, what experiences, and you're giving the person credit for all of those things. You know, what is their learning agility? Have they demonstrated learning agility in the past? And one of the things that I've realized is top talent has the best learning agility. They ramp faster in the first 90 days. They are able to take their competency and know-how and experiences from previous lives, whether it be, you know, at the college level or in athletics or in community service or in another company, they're able to take those things and apply it to the next situation. So I'm really looking for, you know, primarily those things.
That makes sense. I read a number of times about the magic number 3 in every team. What's the significance of that approach? Talk to us a little bit about it.
We touched on it a little bit earlier in that when there's one woman on a team, you know, they become the proxy for all things gender related. And that's not particularly fun at all. And I think when you move from one woman to two women, you start to actually address the business issues that the company is facing and how they can leverage their go-to-market approaches with the actual population of people that they're selling to, which have, you know, women in them, to three women, where you really now become a voice that's, you know, meaningful and appropriate in the team. But even 30% or three women in every team is far from, you know, what the world's population is. I mean, the book is, you know, women hold up half the sky, right? Because they're half the population. So I think, you know, there's no magic in three. It's just that the dynamic of being a woman on a team does change with three. And I've seen this in not only the executive committees that I've served on, but on the boards that I've served on, where, you know, the conversation is much more balanced. And in a business way, this isn't all just about diversity and inclusion. It's about business.
Yeah. So, you know, this actually allowed me to segue into this. You do serve on the board of many organizations, right? And I'm sure it's very challenging to fit it into your busy schedule. So what really drove you to take up these roles on it?
You know, I like to be on boards of companies that really help me expand my vision of the landscape that I'm operating in. And so, you know, I'm on the Duke Energy board, which is a utility company that serves North and South Carolina, parts of Florida, Indiana, Ohio, and on the NXP Semiconductor board, which is the microchip industry. And both of these really help me understand the work that I'm doing, you know, with Snyder. So if you could imagine this new energy landscape, we've always had a generation side, the utility company that generates electricity. And Snyder operates on the demand side, so utility supply. And we work on the demand side. Understanding the supply side of this equation has really helped me in my day job learn more about the challenges, especially as we go into this world of where the supply and the demand side of that grid need to work in much more cooperation and collaboration. So it's been, you know, really helpful for me and also helpful for Duke because I'm very close to their end user. I'm very close to their customers. I'm very close to the dynamics that are happening that are, you know, disrupting the utility segment today. And so, you know, I'm a helpful board member. So it's a mutual benefit. So I don't see it as a burdensome time commitment. I see it as an opportunity to learn. The same with NXP, you know, they're obviously, you know, the advent of electrification and automotive autonomy and, you know, all the intelligence that's being miniaturized into chips is really helping the digital acceleration. And digital plus electrification is the formula for sustainability. So the time I'm spending on NXP is also very, very helpful to me. And yet I represent an industry that they sell into, you know, we don't make dumb devices anymore. Every device that we make, circuit breakers or logic PLCs, logic controllers, they all have intelligence, and that intelligence and that data is very, very powerful. So these boards help me, frankly. And so I look for boards that do that.
Yeah, it ties into your goal of being an everlasting learner, right? That's what I was hearing when you were sharing these perspectives.
Exactly.
So shifting gears, any mistakes in your leadership journey or any challenging experience as you traverse this journey?
When I think about mistakes, I always think about people. You know, were there people I underestimated? Were there people I overtaxed? Were there people that I didn't value as much or that I didn't see in the ways that I should? And so I always reflect about, you know, where I was exactly right on people and maybe where I was not right. And I think it's allowed me to be, you know, quite human to realize that I don't see everything and that listening to how others view people is really important. And it's one of the strengths actually of the Snyder, you know, talent development process is we have these escalating people reviews where leaders come in and talk about their people. And, you know, just realizing that my own perception that I might have of somebody giving me a presentation in 10 minutes doesn't define them. You know, they're defined by their accomplishments and what their leadership is really seeing in them. And so I don't want to say I've made a lot of people mistakes, but it's one of the areas where I'm trying to be really careful to be a good listener and not be too quick to judge.
You know, given that we're now working a lot in virtual environments, what's your view on multitasking? Because I remember, especially during COVID, I would get into meetings with clients. They're on the screen or they're off the screen, but they're trying to do three things at the same time. And I'm talking about this because we spoke about being a good listener and giving your whole self to a conversation.
Yeah, I think multitasking is you know, just kind of rude, both in person and virtually, right? So if someone is multitasking, I mean, I tend to go silent and I wait for them to finish and restart. And I know that people have different views on that. But look, I do think the pressures post-COVID of the schedules is really intense. I mean, I think in COVID, we filled our schedules to the brim. We lost the seams between meetings. We lost the travel time between conference rooms. And so people are overbooking themselves in general now because they have a hybrid environment, some virtuals. And I find it quite intense. And so I do spend time on my calendar, one, to understand, am I working on my priorities, the things that are really important to me and the things that I can make an impact on, and the things that are aligned with my Hoshin, which is my compass, my North Star of, you know, what do I want to accomplish for employees, for shareholders, and for customers. And if I have to multitask, and sometimes you do, I try to take the second and say, I need a second to handle this problem so that people can take the pause with me, realizing that it's quite a busy world. So the thing I really like about the virtual environment is the flexibility that it does give us. And not everything needs to be in person for sure. I think that the other thing that the virtual environment did is it put everybody on a level playing field. You know, one of the worst things now is to be the virtual person in an in-person meeting because your voice is just, you know, completely lost. So I like things to be either mostly in person where the full team is there in person or mostly virtual. But the hybrid, I think, is actually one of the bigger challenges. The other thing you can do is, you know, I don't let the hour define, you know, meeting times. Have 15-minute meetings, have 35-minute meetings. Give yourself the seams in between meetings to do the things that you need to do. So a lot of it is managing your own scheduling.
Yeah. So, Annette, I came across this article in the Wall Street Journal, which was talking about the Indian economy. And the article said, what is holding back India's economic ambition? And the statistics it gave was only 24% of women in India are working or looking for work, despite the country's rapid economic growth, right? And probably sometime back when I really started Atlanta Diaries, there was a McKinsey report, which also talked about the number of women in the workforce declining, and especially in the leadership space. What is your thought on that? And as a leader who really, really gives a lot of importance to talent and pipeline, what are you doing to help solve this serious problem?
You know, India is a really interesting case. And actually, at one point in my career, the executive committee of Snyder had two roles. You had kind of your primary role and a secondary role. And in my case, my primary role was I ran global supply chain. So, you know, 250 factories, 70,000 people around the world. But my secondary role was the country president of India reported to me. So it was a good synergy. I was spending a lot of time in India because of supply chain. And, you know, it was amazing to me that in India, we had a very progressive, Anil Chaudhry's his name, he was a very progressive Indian president who really saw the need and the value in diversity, but was suffering from having women in the workplace at the senior level. So we did some really extensive studies on what was going on. And what we found is India graduates an amazing number of technical women. I mean, it is really spectacular. They enter the workforce, they get married, they have children, and they suddenly become pressured by family and society to really now help those children, you know, prepare for university, prepare for testing, prepare for the future. And these tests, as you'll know, are critical in defining the future of your child, what they can study, what their career will be, and the trajectory of their life. And so what we created was really a policy that allowed women to take a pretty lengthy sabbatical in order to help prepare children for exams and these testing periods. And we were able to get very experienced women back into the workplace in order to then, you know, continue on with their career. And so it became more of pushing a pause button than it was of, you know, sort of exiting the workforce. And this became very successful for us in India, where there's so much talent and so much opportunity, especially for technical graduates from the engineering and technical schools. So that was one way. But I think the point here is just adaptive policies. What is the situation of the country that you're in? You know, what is the culture? And how can you create, you know, policies and opportunities that help you keep women in the workforce, but still adaptive to the challenges that they face in life? And it caused us in Snyder to take a broader look at the term sabbatical and to give people breaks and pauses when they needed it, you know, due to life's many challenges.
And what I'm hearing again is that, you know, the flexibility and the sort of intent to adapt to changing situations. And that's very helpful. And as we approach the end of the conversation, since Atlanta Diaries is a place where inspiring women leaders learn and unlearn their definitions of success. Love to hear your parting thoughts for these leaders as they transition into larger roles.
I think, you know, one of the things I've realized is to be a little more forgiving of myself. I can oftentimes be my worst critic. And I think as I've matured in my own career, you know, I really think about how I want to spend my time and what I want to spend it on. You know, one of my favorite quotes is, "Be the change you want to see in the world," by Mahatma Gandhi. And the reason I like that one is because I am working now on ways to really drive a more decarbonized, more sustainable, more electric future. And I feel it's important for my great nieces and nephews, for the next generation. And it is how I want to spend my time. We spend a lot of hours at work. We spend a lot of hours with our colleagues. And I think I want to do things that I love, that I have passion for, because I think it makes the difference in how you show up every day. And so my biggest advice would be find something you love and then work to be the change that you want to see in the world with respect to that.
That was amazing and very helpful.
Thank you, Enma. Thanks for what you're doing with these podcasts, because I'm sure that they're impacting the women leaders of the future. And so thank you for your dedication to the topic.
Thank you for being a part of this incredible journey with Atlanta Diaries. I have had the privilege of hosting guests who courageously shared their most vulnerable selves with me. And even if only a small segment of these conversations can champion the journey of one person, it will be worth each and every moment. And together, we know we can create an even greater impact. So I do have a humble request for you. If you found value in these episodes, please consider sharing the podcast with your friends, family, and on your social media. I would also love to hear your thoughts and will really appreciate if you could take a moment to leave a review or rating. See you next week for another inspiring journey on Atlanta Diaries.